Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. We are an award-winning public affairs program here on the NPR affiliate, and as far as I'm concerned, a thinly disguised cry for help for me. I'm Tom Hall. I'll be your waiter this afternoon. Let me tell you about our specials. The chef has conjured up a delicate blend of herbs, spices, erudition, and wit. We're calling it the Anne Hornaday. She's a critic, film critic for the Washington Post, and the author of a terrific book called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Tom.
And Jed Dietz is here as well. We call him Dessert back in the green room. You know,
happy to fill in for Dessert. That's to right. Anne's entree.
Right. Yeah, Anne is the entree. Jed's the dessert. Sweet and savory. You can trash movies with a smile on your face, which is very nice. You know, that's a trick to do. So Jed and Anne are here as they are once a month here on Midday. We're going to talk about movies. It is Midday at the Movies. We'd love to hear what you are watching these days, whether you're streaming it at home or going to the theaters. 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wipr.org. If you saw Succession, I have not seen it. I'm planning on streaming it, but I haven't seen it. So, you know, if you want to stay away from the spoiler alerts, that's fine. And if you do spoil it, I don't actually really care. But we can talk about that. We can talk about some of these big movies. Guardians is out, Little Mermaid is out, Across the Spider-Verse and stuff. But let's mention first the writers' strike. And WGA, the Writers Guild of America, sent an email to members that Variety published today saying that this is not going to be like what happened in 2008 when the AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, did a deal with the Directors Guild first. Then they went to the writers and said, we've got this deal with the Directors Guild. You've got to take the same deal. The WGA is saying, this time it's different. The unions are united. They are not going to be able to divide and conquer. And, of course, the biggest of the three unions in this troika is SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild. You know, this time they're saying the unions are more united. What's your read on any possibility for a resolution of this thing?
Well, I mean, I do think if it's always been kind of a truism that if the DGA, I think they go next, right? They authorize.
That's, you know, the directors, right? Uh huh.
The Directors Guild, right? If they strike, and then the actors, I mean, that's a formidable wall. You know, I mean, I think that would. Obviously, it would give you have more leverage when you're working as a coalition, and certainly, you know, the actors being not only numerically powerful but just powerful in terms of their persona and their importance to the creative process. I mean, everybody's important in this one, but they you know, I do think it would certainly, because I think when we spoke last time, it didn't look like the producers were moving at all, you know, I mean, nothing.
They haven't actually been talking since May 1st, yeah, which is when the strike started and negotiations ended. And it looks like the producers are sort of moving on to the directors, and the directors may go on strike as early as a week or two, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
so,
there's
been no movement, that's for sure. So we're in the fifth week of the writer's strike. I think you're right. It would be a formidable wall if all three unions. But Jed, what do you think of the chances of that actually holding?
Well, I think the most complicating thing is just the way the business is shifting, and the streaming service that's good for all of us consumers in so many ways is disrupting, obviously, theater attendance coming back now. But we've talked about that on air. What it's really disrupting is the way broadcast television is working. And, you know,
and all the late night shows are in reruns and stuff.
Yeah. Well, and even the series, you know, the big thing was you would gamble on a pilot. If they picked up the pilot, you get a 10 show order, and then you might run for 5 seasons or 9 seasons or something. And that's when your real payday would come in and all your work would come in. And that model seems to have just sort of disappeared. I mean, the great hit Succession that you mentioned is 4 seasons and 10 shows. You know, it's 41 hours of television. I mean, that's tiny compared to Friends or Seinfeld or, you know, even a modest hit. So that's the big problem. And I think the studios don't know how to give up something to the talent because they just don't know what the inflow is going
to
be.
Yeah. And when it comes to trends, Ann, Forbes had a piece a week or two ago about the kind of money that some of these companies are losing. Disney alone lost 3.6 million paid subscribers to streaming. 4 million subscribers dropped from Disney Plus, so the their total subscriber base is now down to 157 million people. I think Netflix has more than twice that. What do you have any idea what the number for profitability from Disney needs to be? 157 million people is still a lot of people. But when they had a price hike, a lot of people left. They lost millions of people in India to a cricket thing. They're streaming cricket instead of Disney. How far back do they have to come in order to, you know, think of themselves as profitable?
Well, I mean, I guess I this is really not this is way above my pay grade in terms of the business analysis. But because it's such a huge conglomerate, you know, it depends on how you slice and dice it, because I think some areas of the company are still hugely profitable, I think, you know. And so, you know.
Yeah, their theme parks made $2.2 billion.
Right.
You know.
Or as Succession fans would know, the Tom part of the business, you know. little Succession joke there. So, you know, in terms of for the overall corporate, you know, profitability, that's one calculation. I have zero idea what they need to bring, you know, the filmed entertainment pieces back, because as we all know, especially in streaming, the numbers are really opaque, you know. I mean, right. I just, that's a black box. And so but I mean,
and that's perhaps another possible problem with the writers. I mean, they're
that's
not
right.
even quite sure what they're
that's
owed
exactly
from
right.
streaming, because, you know, the numbers of people who actually do it. And, you know, how do you calculate streaming if you hit the
right.
wrong
What's
button and something
right.
you know streams for a minute and a half? Does that mean it's been downloaded, you know?
Yep.
If you fall asleep after 10 minutes and turn it off, does that count? I mean, it's a really interesting thing. So with these big movies that are out, Jed, for example, you've seen Guardians.
Yes.
I know both of you guys have checked out Little Mermaid, which I hear all sorts of mixed things about. And then there's this big Spider-Man across the Spider-Verse. Are the big movies bringing people back to the theater again? It's summer. This is when these big movies come out.
Yeah, but they are. I mean, this goes back even a year ago when the COVID stuff was starting to taper off, and the big, you know, Top Gun was the first one that sort of led the charge and purposely under Cruise's leadership really went into movie theaters and stayed in movie theaters, is now also being streamed, and it's having a big impact in both places. And so people are coming back. I think, you know, Little Mermaid is a formula film from Disney that they've been making these live action
yeah. of the animated film.
And I we were talking a little bit before the show started. I saw it with my granddaughter, who's 7. She went nuts over this movie. I thought it was way too, and I liked the Little Mermaid. I liked the animated. I thought there were parts of this that were stunning to look at. And I think there's something going on that with 3D that's very interesting, and I feel this about Guardians too. But they tend to, Anne has written about this, they tend to be over bloating these movies. And maybe,
yeah, because the rap on this movie is just too long.
It is too long.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's objectively too long. Although the audience I saw with Clara clapped at
right,
the end.
Right.
And there was applause.
They were
the
sad
end.
It was over, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, but like with a thing like Across the Spider-Verse, Anne, I mean, again, you thought that one, you wrote about this in the Post, you thought that one was pretty long too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's a thing, you know. But to Jed's point though about how the audience reacts, I do think that the studios have conditioned audiences into thinking that that's value, you know, that they're getting more value out of a movie if they tack on 20 minutes that nobody asked for and that the movie doesn't need. But it just, I just think there's some strange psychological transaction that occurs, or behavioral economics, where people are like, oh, well, I got my money's worth, even though narratively, you can't really defend it. I mean, I just, it's a strange phenomenon, and I personally cannot stand it. I mean, I felt, yes, The Little Mermaid was too long. I think every weakness of that movie, and I think some of the new songs work better than others. You know, I can find fault with it, but as a showcase for Halle Bailey, she just is absolutely sensational. Yeah. And so with her kind of carrying you through this movie, it makes an otherwise what might have been a really unpleasant experience just thoroughly delightful, just because she's so fantastic.
Yeah.
I thought Melissa McCarthy was great too. Did you?
Yeah, she's great too. But obviously, you know, the main thing is Halle Bailey going to stick the landing or not? And she completely does.
Yeah, good for her. That's true. Always fun to see.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
to see
wonderful to watch
a young kid, you know, have a big hit. We have a caller. Mike is on the line from Hamden. Mike, you saw something at Cinema Sunday, show a film called Monica. You liked it, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I thought Monica was really good, and the audience gave it a pretty good reception, except some people thought it was slow. But you know, I didn't agree with that. I thought that here's a trans woman who's returning to help with her mother, who's dying from a brain tumor. Her mom had kicked her out, stuck her on a bus, and said, "I can't be your mother anymore," a number of years back, and she's not sure how she's going to deal with mom, and so she plays by ear and reacts to mom. I thought it was extremely well done, and Tracy Lizette did a terrific job, and Patricia Clarkson was the mom, and she was just fabulous as always.
Oh, that's good to hear, Jed. I mean, you had a pretty good reaction.
Oh yeah,
as
I
well.
Totally agree with him. I mean, and I think the methodology of this film is to put most of us in a slightly awkward situation. It's a tough family situation, and the whole sexuality of it is maybe uneasy for some people. And I think the choice of slowing it down and letting the characters develop, letting you really sort of contemplate as they do with each other, there's been some division in the family, is exactly the right artistic choice. And I agree with him that the two lead actors, the mother and the daughter, are just extraordinary. And I think it's a very important movie. And I thought the soundtrack was actually great, too.
Terrific. Monica, it's at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore. And Anne, not only do we have these live action, you know, like the live action version of Little Mermaid, but we have live action movies that are then being animated. There's a movie called Spidey, right, which is a animated version of Spider-Man. So they're just trying to cash in left, right, and center here. I mean, that's wild. I mean, you saw Spidey? That's an animated version.
Well, we call it Spidey. Yeah, that's the nickname. It's really it's Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. That's the official title,
as you said.
And animated, yes. And this is the sequel.
Oh, so that's the same thing, the same movie. It's not like
same movie. Yeah, we just call it. Yeah, I think we've been in our planning emails. We've been calling it Spidey just for short because it's such a long title. But yeah,
so this new Spider-Man movie is an animated movie.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a sequel to another the one that came out a few years ago.
Just to remind everybody, my life is pathetic. I don't get out much. I had no idea.
No, because there are so many. Movies, though. There are so many Spider-Man movies. It's insane. And so you have every right to not be able to keep track of them all, because I can barely keep track of them all.
But in these
animated, but the animated films really are sensational. I mean, they're just absolutely spectacular. The animation is so dazzling, so beautiful. Narratively, I was not a big fan of this one. I think it's convoluted and frenetic and hard to follow, But the visuals are just so glorious, and the acting, you know, the voice performances are fantastic. The characterizations are terrific. So this was definitely a mixed bag.
A lot going for it, but on the other hand, right, I get it.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the importance of I guess maybe, you know, what you consider, Anne, to be the granddaddy of them all, Iron Man, which is 15 years ago. That came out, and you wrote a really interesting piece about the upside to Iron Man and what that's meant for the genre and the downside. We'll talk about it when we come back with Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. Her book is called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies, and Jed Dietz, he's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Give us a call. Let us know what you're watching. 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wypr.org. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on the show, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. Next month, the law in Maryland will change to allow the legal use of recreational cannabis. And on Monday, we'll talk with Dr. Wen about the ramifications of this for public health. So that's coming up Monday on Midday. And now it's back to Midday at the Movies and my continuing education about what's going on in movie theaters, because clearly there's so much I don't know. Anne Hornaday is with us from The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. We'd love to hear what you're watching these days. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Mike over in Hamden loved Monica at the Charles Theater. Let us know what you think. And give us a quick summary of why you think Iron Man was such an important movie 15 long years ago.
Well, you know, we were talking about Spider-Man just now, and that was back when, you know, we had already had the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie, and Christopher Nolan was doing the Batman movies. And those, you know, even though Tim Burton had done Batman and brought his own brand of kind of stylized darkness to it, Nolan brought a whole other level of darkness to Batman. And I just, you know, the movies were getting very self-serious and kind of, you know, I think a little bit self-conscious and sort of weighted down by their own sort of sense of canonical importance. And then here comes Iron Man, starring Robert Downey Jr., who had had his own ups and downs, and he was not necessarily considered a sure bet in terms of, you know, a bankable star or even a reliable co-worker. And so there were a lot of questions about whether this would work. It was the first movie that Marvel Studios did. You know, they had been licensing their characters and their comic books to other companies, but they finally had formed their own production company. So this was the first to come out under that shingles. There were a lot of doubts and a lot of questions about whether it would work. And of course, it worked beautifully. I mean, I remember going to that screening being so skeptical, and kind of already exhausted by the comic book genre and thinking, God, you know, what are they, how can they make this feel new? And then they did. And it was a function of the writing. It was a function of Downey, who was just absolutely perfect and just slipped so seamlessly into that role. And it was a function of Jon Favreau's direction, which I thought was just really smart and tasteful. And it worked. And so, of course, Hollywood being Hollywood, you know, they drive it and, you know, they sort of kept doing it. And, you know, I think they took great lessons from that. Number one, the importance of casting. So we saw really interesting, you know, like Mark Ruffalo as the Hulk, which I don't think anybody saw coming. Great actor in a role that, you know, might have been deemed too silly for him at one point. But now everybody's, you know, everybody's doing these movies and they're getting really outstanding actors to do the roles. They're getting, like, they're plucking from the indie pipeline, Ryan Coogler, to do Black Panther. They're going to Sundance now to get the directors. They're not so people with, you know, distinct visions and distinct tastes.
And that should be an upside, right?
That's the upside. The downside is almost the same as the upside, which is now it is such a hegemonic force in Hollywood that it's almost like you have to do these movies in order to even have a career. And inevitably, some are going to work better than others. And I think, you know, in a lot of cases, I would point to Chloe Zhao being the most recent.
She's the director of The Eternals, right?
Yeah, an Oscar.
Correct. And before that, Nomadland and The Writer. And talk about a director with a very distinctive vision, but it was completely flattened out by the Marvel kind of behemoth where they give you this list of deliverables. You know, here's what you know, fan service and canon and all those kind of, you know, imperatives. And I don't think it serves those directors particularly very well. And I don't think, I just think the form has really become exhausted. And even the Downey kind of quippy humor, which I found so refreshing and delightful in that first movie, has almost infiltrated everything. So everything's kind of snarky and it's got a little wink to it. And it's very self-referential, you know, very self-parodying, which it can get old real fast.
Jed, I mean, there's an upside and a downside to all of these, you know, iconic films.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what it comes down to, though, is having the guts to continue to be creative with a franchise, as they did with the Spider-Man animation. And we'll see how well the new one sounds like. It could be a blockbuster just coming out. But I think that it takes some guts to do that. Black Panther was a great example. I mean, who knew
that
would work?
That was a gutsy movie, yeah.
Bob Iger, personally, the head of Disney at the time, made a huge bet, $250 million budget, if I remember, which that was big money back in those days. And it worked. And it's become its own franchise. And so we'll see. I mean, I think, you know, it's the challenge. And that's one of the things that's really in the mix now for
yes,
all
the ancient
studios.
Halcyon days of when they made Black Panther.
Right? Exactly.
I'm old enough to remember Black Panther. Yeah, that's for sure. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, Ann Hornaday, film critic for the Washington Post. 410-662-8780. We're going to talk about some of the movies that are currently in local cinemas. midday@wypr.org if you want to comment via email. Let's go to the phones to Vivian, who's on the line from Cockeysville. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I am not going to talk about something that's current. I'm going to ask about something that's in the past. Yesterday, I viewed Billy Elliot.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my all-time favorite movies. And I got it via the Netflix DVD service, which is going to end.
Yep.
And I wonder what are going to be my options going to be to find movies that may not be currently popular.
Well, you know, that I don't know. I mean, Jed, do you have any idea what kind of the ending of the DVD service, what that means for the library of streaming services like Netflix?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's a real issue right now with Netflix being the biggest, you know, supplier, having put all the video stores out of business. Now they're coming out of the DVD business. And the DVDs are really important for the historic films and in all the ways they're used, sometimes just as entertainment. I mean, here we're lucky because we have a wonderful video store, new one on Howard Street, with people running it who really know a lot about movies. And I think that's what the kind of thing that's going to happen. Obviously, Amazon is still a place you can go and buy DVDs. And you know, I don't think they're going to go away.
Anne, I mean, how does it work? Do people can Netflix not hold on to all of these titles in their library? Is that just too expensive to maintain them? Do they have to pay a monthly fee to own them or something?
Yeah, I think we can just assume that it's all economic at that point.
Yeah,
I would encourage people to check out Beyond Video on Howard Street and their libraries too. I mean, the libraries still have physical media.
Yeah, Pratt Library certainly has a lot of DVDs.
Absolutely, they have a wonderful, wonderful collection.
Yeah,
that's a great point. Yeah, it is infuriating though that Netflix, like Jed just put it beautifully. You know, they stomp out all the local video stores and then
quit themselves. Maybe we're headed back to Blockbuster. That would be fun. Well, Vivian, good luck on that. That's a great question, and I appreciate the call. Let's talk about a couple of movies that are in local theaters. This is one we almost saw last weekend, Linnell and I, and then we ended up going to the Orioles game instead. It's called You Hurt My Feelings. It's about a novelist who's married to a guy who's, I think, a psychologist.
Psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist. Yep. You know, the way things happen in marriages, you know, stuff gets said and you wonder, can this marriage be saved? Here's a little clip from You Hurt My Feelings.
I look tired. I'm aging.
What are you, nuts?
Well, you get Botox.
Well, I just get a little bit right here. You know, I can still move my eyebrows. Watch.
Oh, yeah. It's so expressive.
Since when are you so vain?
I don't know. I was young and hot.
Well, you're still younger than me.
As Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tobias Menzies. And this is a movie that's gotten a lot of good buzz. I know you wrote about it quite glowingly.
Yes, I'm a huge fan. This is from one of my very favorite filmmakers, Nicole Holofcener, who is just, she should be much better known than she is. I mean, she writes these incredibly funny, wise, observational comedy dramas that are just so rooted in lived experience. And then she just sort of heightens it enough to make it thoroughly entertaining. And for a long time, you know, her kind of alter ego on screen was Catherine Keener, who's fantastic and wonderful. And then for the last couple of movies, she's gone with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is, you know, they obviously are in sync in some way. I mean, she really does feel like the perfect avatar for Nicole. And as you said, this is about a marriage that reaches a crisis point when Julia's character overhears her husband saying something about her work that just sends her down a rabbit hole of like wondering if she even knows him or if he knows her. And it's just, again, it's just, it's funny and it's smart and it's kind of that kind of movie that we're always afraid they don't make anymore. And so I would really encourage people to go see this in the theater. Go with a date, go with friends. You know, it's just a delightful experience.
Yeah, maybe don't go with your spouse, though. That could get
dicey.
No,
it's about being in love.
That could be a date. That's what I meant by date. Yeah.
But, Jed, I mean, you know, this has been very well received. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus evidently is very close friends personally with Nicole.
Well, she was in a movie that Nicole made a few years back, James Gandolfini's last movie, and I would argue, with all due respect, The Sopranos, which I love, but one of his great performances. Also about people falling in love and staying in love and being buddies. And this is a terrific movie, very beautifully written. And I agree with everything Anne said about Nicole's work. I mean, she's been creating movies for a number of years now and has been awarded lots of stuff, but people need to go to them, and this is especially good. And the whole cast is really great, including Ariane Moyad, who is in Succession.
Oh, there you go.
Stewie.
That's right. All right, You Hurt My Feelings. Here's a clip from a movie called Starling Girl. This is about a young girl, a teenager, Jem Starling, and her Christian fundamentalist community and a magnetic youth pastor named Owen.
You've let Satan into your heart.
I haven't.
Oh, you have. He's whispering into your ear.
Do you think I'm wicked?
The best thing for everyone is for you to go away.
You gotta do this, or you can't be part of this family.
I repent all of the wrong deeds and the lustful and immoral thoughts in my mind.
To give something up, it's just so he got more room for you.
I want a heart full of love. I want it to fill me to the brim.
Oh, a light and airy rom-com there. Every time I think it's Satan whispering in my ear, I realize it's just my producer, Tariya Rogers. You know, but you know, and I rarely mistake those two. But Jed, what do you think? This is pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, it's a first-time filmmaker, Laurel Permont, and a wonderful cast. I mean, the two leads, Eliza Scanlon, is this young actress from Australia who's been in Sharp Objects, which is another one of the streaming ones, but it was also in Little Women, Greta Gerwig's Little Women. It is just terrific. And Lewis Pullman plays the preacher son that she is attracted to, which allows Satan to get into her ear. But I think the danger, and it played at Sundance and was well received, bought out of Sundance by Bleecker Street. I think the danger in a movie like this is when you go into a community like a deeply religious community, the danger is always sort of caricaturing that community. And I think that happens a bit here, which mm-hmm. really sort of undercuts the movie. But the leads are great, and it's a sincere effort, you know.
So, Anne, I want to move on to another movie because we got a few to talk about that seem really interesting. And this one is called Reality. And you've written about this. And this is kind of an interesting example of it's a documentary. Is it a drama? Mm. I mean, they meld a couple of genres here, don't they?
Oh, this is one of my favorite movies that's available right now. It really blew me away. It's on HBO. Or I guess, what do we call that now? Max? HBO Max? Anyway,
yeah.
it's on Max.
Yeah,
Max. It's based on a play called Is This a Room by Tina Satter. And Tina Satter adapted her own play into this movie. And the ingenuity of it is that all of the dialogue is taken from an FBI transcript of when two agents approached a young woman named Reality Winner at her home in Augusta, Georgia. And interrogated her for around 2 or 3 hours about whether or not she had leaked a classified document. She was a contractor with NSA. And Sydney Sweeney, who most people know from The White Lotus and Euphoria, it plays Reality Winner in this movie and is absolutely stunning. It's like, this is a cliche, but it's like Sydney Sweeney like you've never seen her before. I mean, she's no discernible makeup, very dressed down. It's an intense, taut, suspenseful movie. Even if you know the story of Reality Winner, you are so caught up in the drama of the moment, and it almost unfolds in real time. It's just brilliant. And again, that melding of a real-life transcript with dramatization, it's hugely effective. And I just think another first film, by the way. This is Tina Satter's debut and an incredibly assured and promising one.
Oh, cool. And so, Jed, I mean, this is a trend we think will continue to talk about, ripped from the headlines.
It's certainly a trend we hope because of the creativity involved in it. I mean, this is literally taking transcription of a recorded interview, as Anne said, and turning it into this movie. And so, and what it shows you, first of all, this is a very surprising character. It's Sydney Sweeney, so 25-year-old, attractive young woman. She comes out of an office. That's how you start to see her. Well, it turns out, you know, she's had commendation medals from the Air Force. She speaks 3 Persian languages. She's an unbelievably accomplished person, a weightlifter. And you learn all this in this movie, and it's so beautifully drawn, just the way Anne said. And the way they've used, I mean, this is a stage director, Tina Satter, but the way she's used camera and photographs is really beautiful. And mm-hmm. and the trivialities that slip in mm-hmm. in the middle of all this tension are just fantastic to see. And it's a totally revealing thing. And I will tell you, it's about a classified document, which I think we're going to be paying a lot of attention to.
Incredibly timely.
Yeah, that will continue to be in the news. Okay, Reality, which is on Max, formerly the artist formerly known as HBO Max. Let's listen to a final clip. This is a movie called Bo is Afraid. This is a guy who loses his mother quite unexpectedly, and then chaos ensues.
She's very pretty. Is that the type of girl you're attracted to?
I am so sorry for what your daddy passed down to you. I wanted a child.
I'm visiting my mother tomorrow.
Do you ever wish that she was dead?
What?
Bo? Are you on your way?
I'm on my way. I just... It's not safe, is it?
I sincerely doubt that.
I'm sure you'll do the right thing, sweetheart.
All right, it's just the trailer, Anne, but is this movie as bad as it seems? My gosh.
I mean, in my humble opinion, yes. I was actually optimistic about it in the first 20 minutes because the filmmaker Ari Aster, who has really gained a cult following with his movies Hereditary and Midsommar, he is really a great world builder. I mean, he gets you into these atmospheres that he builds, these environments, and they are just, they're brilliant. And in this case, it is inhabited by Bo Wasserman, played by Joaquin Phoenix, who's, of course, very compelling and charismatic and, you know, easy to watch. But then he takes them on this journey that is so kind of desultory and random and ultimately, in my mind, does not really go anywhere and certainly doesn't go anywhere other than this kind of very kind of banal cliche about mommy mean to me, you know. I just did not get anything really deeply meaningful out of this movie, I'm sorry to say.
All right, so that might be a skipper, you know. We might have skipped that one. That's okay. You know, that's what we're here for.
It's interesting. I mean, Anne's right that a lot of eyes are on Ari Aster, and we had a couple of shorts, and there some of them are available on the web. There's one called Bo that this was extended to make a feature that we had at the festival actually years ago, and another one called Basically that I would also recommend, that Rachel Brosnahan plays the lead character.
And per our phone call from Vivian earlier in the program, we have Maggie who says absolutely the Enoch Pratt still loans out DVDs if you're interested in that. We have an email from Larry who loved the lollipop cover. He calls it a stark yet very touching 1965 film. It takes place on the California coast, and he viewed it on YouTube. He says they sometimes have older, lesser-known films. And Margaret says, I have Disney Plus, which I got when they broadcast Hamilton, and she's stuck with it. And right now, with broadcast TV being so pathetically overrun by unscripted shows, streaming is a godsend. So there's a happy Disney customer.
Yeah, good.
All right. Thanks so much. Well, Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post. The book is called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Thank you very much. We'll see you next month.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom. See you next month.
And coming up, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will join me with a review of Exclusion at Arena Stage in Washington. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.